If some fellow traveler were to go on to say that the Russians are also your brothers, he would be unable to persuade you unless he could show that we are in danger from the Martians. We love those who hate our enemies. And if we had no enemies, there would be very few people whom we should love. All this, however, is only true so long as we are concerned solely with attitudes towards other human beings. You might regard the soil as your enemy, because it yields reluctantly and niggardly subsistence. You might regard Mother Nature in general as your enemy, and envisage human life as a struggle to get the better of Mother Nature. If men viewed life in this way, cooperation of the whole human race would become easy. And men could easily be brought to view life in this way, if schools, newspapers, and politicians devoted themselves to this end. But schools are out to teach patriotism, newspapers are out to stir up excitement, and politicians are out to get re-elected. None of the three, therefore, can do anything towards saving the human race from reciprocal suicide. There are two ways of coping with fear. One is to diminish the external danger, and the other is to cultivate stoic endurance. Stoic endurance can be reinforced, except where immediate action is necessary, by turning our thoughts away from the cause of fear. The conquest of fear is of very great importance. Fear is in itself degrading. It easily becomes an obsession. It produces hate of that which is feared, and it leads headlong to excesses of cruelty. Nothing has so beneficent an effect on human beings as security. If an international system could be established which would remove the fear of war, the improvement in the everyday mentality of everyday people would be enormous and very rapid. Fear, at present, overshadows the world. The atom bomb and the bacterial bomb, wielded by the wicked communist or the wicked capitalist, as the case may be, makes Washington and the Kremlin tremble, and drives men further and further along the road towards the abyss. If matters are to improve, the first and essential step is to find a way of diminishing fear. The world at present is obsessed by the conflict of rival ideologies, and one of the apparent causes of conflict is the desire for the victory of our own ideology and the defeat of the other. I do not think that the fundamental motive here has much to do with ideologies. I think the ideologies are merely a way of grouping people, and that the passions involved are merely those which always arise between rival groups. There are, of course, various reasons for hating communists. First and foremost, we believe that they wish to take away our property. But so do burglars. And although we disapprove of burglars, our attitude towards them is very different indeed from our attitude towards communists, chiefly because they do not inspire the same degree of fear. Secondly, we hate the communists because they are irreligious. But the Chinese have been irreligious since the 11th century, and we only began to hate them when they turned out Chiang Kai-shek. Thirdly, we hate the communists because they do not believe in democracy. But we consider this no reason for hating Franco. Fourthly, we hate them because they do not allow liberty. This we feel so strongly that we have decided to imitate them. It is obvious that none of these are the real grounds for our hatred. We hate them because we fear them and they threaten us. If the Russians still adhered to the Greek Orthodox religion, if they had instituted parliamentary government, and if they had a completely free press which daily vituperated us, then, provided they still had armed forces as powerful as they have now, we should still hate them if they gave us ground for thinking them hostile. There is, of course, the odium theologicum, and it can be a cause of enmity. But I think that this is an offshoot of herd feeling. The man who has a different theology feels strange, and whatever is strange may be dangerous. Ideologies, in fact, are one of the methods by which herds are created, and the psychology is much the same, however the herd may have been generated. You may have the feeling that I have allowed only for bad motives, or at best, such as are ethically neutral. I am afraid they are, as a rule, more powerful than more altruistic motives. But I do not deny that altruistic motives exist and may, on occasion, be effective. The agitation against slavery in England in the early 19th century was indubitably altruistic and was thoroughly effective. Its altruism was proved by the fact that in 1833, British taxpayers paid many millions in compensation to Jamaica landowners for the liberation of their slaves, and also by the fact that at the Congress of Vienna, the British government was prepared to make important concessions with a view to inducing other nations to abandon the slave trade. This is an instance from the past, but present-day America has afforded instances equally remarkable. I will not, however, go into these, as I do not wish to become embarked upon current controversies. I do not think it can be questioned that sympathy is a genuine motive, and that some people at some times are made somewhat uncomfortable by the sufferings of some other people. It is sympathy that has produced the many humanitarian advances of the last 100 years. We are shocked when we hear stories of the ill-treatment of lunatics, and there are now quite a number of asylums in which lunatics are not ill-treated. Prisoners in Western countries are not supposed to be tortured, and when they are, there is an outcry if the facts are discovered. We do not approve of treating orphans as they are treated in Oliver Twist. Protestant countries disapprove of cruelty to animals. In all these ways, sympathy has been politically effective. If the fear of war were removed, its effectiveness would become much greater. Perhaps the best hope for the future of mankind is that ways will be found of increasing the scope and intensity of sympathy. The time has come to sum up this discussion. Politics is concerned with herds rather than with individuals, and the passions which are important in politics are therefore those in which the various members of a given herd can feel alike. The broad instinctive mechanism upon which political edifices have to be built is one of cooperation within the herd and hostility towards other herds. The cooperation within the herd is never perfect. There are members who do not conform, who are, in the etymological sense, egregious, that is to say, outside the flock. These members are those who have fallen below or risen above the ordinary level. They are idiots, criminals, prophets, and discoverers. A wise herd will learn to tolerate the eccentricity of those who rise above the average and to treat with a minimum of ferocity those who fall below it. As regards relations to other herds, modern technique has produced a conflict between self-interest and instinct. In old days, when two tribes went to war, one of them exterminated the other and annexed its territory. From the point of view of the victor, the whole operation was thoroughly satisfactory. The killing was not at all expensive, and the excitement was agreeable. It is not to be wondered at that in such circumstances war persisted. Unfortunately, we still have the emotions appropriate to such primitive warfare, while the actual operations of war have changed completely. Killing an enemy in a modern war is a very expensive operation. If you consider how many Germans were killed in the late war and how much the victors are paying in income tax, you can, by a sum in long division, discover the cost of a dead German, and you will find it considerable. In the East, it is true, The enemies of the Germans have secured the ancient advantages of turning out the defeated population and occupying their lands. The Western victors, however, have secured no such advantages. It is obvious that modern war is not good business from a financial point of view. Although the West won both world wars, we should now be much richer if they had not occurred. If men were actuated by self-interest, which they are not, except in the case of a few saints, the whole human race would cooperate. There would be no more wars, no more armies, no more navies, no more atom bombs. There would not be armies of propagandists employed in poisoning the minds of nation A against nation B, and reciprocally of nation B against nation A. There would not be armies of officials at frontiers to prevent the entry of foreign books and foreign ideas, however excellent in themselves. There would not be customs barriers to ensure the existence of many small enterprises where one big enterprise would be more economic. All this would happen very quickly if men desired their own happiness as ardently as they desire the misery of their neighbors. But you will tell me, what is the use of these utopian dreams? Moralists will see to it that we do not become wholly selfish. And until we do, the millennium will be impossible. I do not wish to seem to end upon a note of cynicism. I do not deny that there are better things than selfishness, and that some people achieve these things. I maintain, however, on the one hand, that there are few occasions upon which large bodies of men, such as politics is concerned with, can rise above selfishness, while, on the other hand, there are a very great many circumstances in which populations will fall below selfishness, if selfishness is interpreted as enlightened self-interest. And among those occasions on which people fall below self-interest are most of the occasions on which they are convinced that they are acting from what are called idealistic motives. Much that passes as idealism is disguised hatred or disguised love of power. When you see large bodies of men swayed by what appear to be noble motives, it is as well to look below the surface and ask yourself what it is that makes these motives effective. It is partly because it is so easy to be taken in by a facade of nobility that a psychological inquiry, such as I have been attempting, is worth making. I would say in conclusion that if what I have said is right, the main thing needed to make the world happy is intelligence. And this, after all, is an optimistic conclusion, because intelligence is a thing that can be fostered by known methods of education.